Sometimes the most interesting stories get left on the cutting room floor. I'm Julie Amacher. Each week I share a new classical recording with you featuring some of the world's best musicians on new classical tracks. I'm counting down six of my favorite interviews from 2016. It's New Classical Tracks Uncut, giving you a chance to hear more about your favorite musicians and their newest recordings. This week, a conversation from March of 2016 with violinist Rachel Barton Pine. Well, I'm just going to dive in about your recording. And Rachel, I would love for you to start off by telling me a little bit about when you were first exposed to the music of Bach, which I know happened right in your hometown church in Chicago.
Yes, well, my parents started attending a United Church of Christ, St. Paul's UCC in Chicago, when I was a little baby. And I was surrounded by the music of Bach. The organist would play toccatas and fugues as prelude music. The choir would sing movements of oratorios. There's even a stained glass window of Bach in the sanctuary, believe it or not, mixed in amongst, you know, characters from the Bible stories and stuff. So Bach is really present. It was at St. Paul's that I first encountered the violin when some older girls played one Sunday when I was 3 years old, and I started begging my parents for lessons. And then when I was four, I first played a Bach work as part of worship, and you know, kept doing that ever since. And I feel like Bach's music really brings me back to that, you know, sense of why I am a musician and what it means to be a musician, that you're, you know, a conduit for something greater than yourself, and that you can, you know, reach out and share it with everyone who's listening to uplift their spirits. Of course, with Bach's music, you know, even his works that were not explicitly sacred were, I think, all written, you know, to serve his creator. And you can, you know, whatever your belief might be religiously, I think when you play Bach's music, you just feel like, you know, you're in touch with something greater than yourself, and this sense of spirituality that pervades everything he wrote.
I'm just curious, what was that piece that you played when you were just 4 years old?
Well, that would have been one of those little minuets that children often do.
And was it the German ladies at the church that encouraged you a little bit?
Oh, well, gosh, everybody, including the pastors, was, you know, very supportive. But there was actually a pivotal moment when I was 5 years old. My Sunday school class went over to the nursing home affiliated with my church, and we were going to go around and sing Christmas carols, but I had brought my little violin, and I guess I, you know, some of the songs I knew were ones that they didn't have words for, and we had different keys, and so it ended up that I actually started wandering down a different hallway than they did, sort of following a different path that day. And so the nurse that was with me, you know, I was going, you know, room by room, serenading each occupant, and then I got to a particular room, and the nurse took me aside and said, you know, not to be put off, but that the gentleman in that room, that they felt that he was capable of speaking, but was choosing not to speak because he was unhappy and didn't want to be there, and, you know, not to let that worry or upset me if he didn't talk when I played for him. And I said, okay, well, that'll be a little odd, but I can handle it. So I went and played for him, and at the end of my little performance, he started crying and talking about how he had played the violin when he was a child. And then the nurse started crying and my mom started crying. And I just realized that music has a power to communicate, you know, when other ways of communication sometimes, you know, it just goes beyond, you know, other ways that we might communicate with each other, and that it has this power to move us and to accomplish, you know, great things. And that I could be a part of that. You know, I realized that this is what I was meant to do with my life. And so that's when I started signing my kindergarten papers, Rachel Violinist, and really thinking of myself not as someone who plays the violin, but as a violinist. Like, that was my whole identity. And the reason that that was my identity is that I wanted to be part of using music for good in the world, not just playing prestigious concerts, but bringing my music to people everywhere. And I've been so blessed to have had the opportunity to do a lot of that, you know, traveling around to a different city or country every week. I always get to go, you know, sometimes to schools. I've played in jails a few times, occasionally in homeless shelters. I was just at a children's hospital last week. So, you know, being able to take my music where it's really going to mean something to people inside and outside the concert hall is why I do what I do.
Now, did you return to your childhood church to make this recording?
Yeah, well, we still go there. And when I was thinking about what would be a good acoustic for the album, I knew that I always loved hearing Bach in my church, but I was a little suspicious whether my opinion was tainted by sentimentality and polluted by familiarity. So I wanted to get my engineer's ears in on it, and so we went and did a little acoustical check, and he experimented with mic placement and where I would be positioned and so forth. And then we got something we liked, and we sent it to the producer, and he said, "Oh, this is lovely. You know, you're not going to find a church better than this, so we might as well do it in the church you know and love." So once we started the session, we realized that the acoustic really is actually exceptional. It has a combination of reverb, you know, of bloom to the sound, you might say, and also clarity. A lot of really echoey churches sometimes, you know, the music will end up sounding garbled, so then you end up wanting to record in a more clean space and then adding, you know, sort of fake reverb after the fact. But this St. Paul's has a combination of both, the clarity and the reverb, which is so lucky. So our recording uses this very unusual. We just use one pair of mics, and there's no doctoring of the sound post-production. You're just getting the live sound from these two mics, and that's that.
Now, I think it's interesting because most of us are aware that Bach was a genius composer and an amazing keyboard player, but I think sometimes we forget he was also a violinist.
Well, exactly. And, you know, Bach's first instrument was the violin, which he learned from his violinist father. And many of his first jobs involved significant duties on violin. But I think the most telling fact is that the fugue of the third sonata, the sonata in C major for unaccompanied violin, is the longest fugue that he ever wrote. If you ask somebody, what do you think Bach wrote his longest fugue for? Some people would probably say, you know, maybe ensemble, like an orchestra or chamber group. Some people might think it would be for organ, but it was for violin, this little instrument with only four strings. And, you know, not just long, like, you know, overly outstaying its welcome, but just this movement that is absolutely glorious. And I think that's what makes this set of music so extraordinary, is that, you know, Bach compositionally, the way that he crafted the music was like nobody else. I mean, he certainly stood on the shoulders of this, 60 plus year German tradition of improvising and composing in multiple voices for violin alone. And we have examples written down by Westhoff and Bieber and so forth. But nonetheless, you know, Bach definitely took it to the next level, as they say. But, you know, you can look and see, oh my gosh, this is, you know, just technically amazing in terms of how he crafted it with the fugue subject inverted and in bariolage and with the counter subject and this and that and the other. And you can analyze the whole thing and you know, be in awe. But then when you listen to it, you don't think about any of that stuff. You're just on an emotional journey. Bach is telling a story with this music that leaves you, you know, this transcendent feeling at the end. And the fact that he could do something so extraordinary with his composing, but then actually surpass that to the point where that's only in the service of what he's saying with the music. I mean, it's absolutely miraculous.
Now, why did you decide to record these fugues and partitas now at this point in your life, in your career?
Well, it was never a question of if. It was always a question of when. And with my recorded output, it's like, hey, I haven't even done the Tchaikovsky concerto yet. But, you know, there's a long list of things I need to do, and you can't do them all simultaneously. You have to sort of do one and then the next and then the next. And I like to mix it up between solo records and concertos with orchestra, between early music types of things and later repertoire from the, you know, 20th century or 19th century. So, you know, it's just a question of balance. I really believe that when I'm 80, I'm going to have such a deeper understanding of this music, I'll probably want to re-record the whole thing. But I felt like after this many years of living with it and experimenting with it, and also getting to know a lot of the music that influenced Bach, you know, the album that I made of French Baroque music and all of the time I've spent with that literature, and then Bach's Third Partita, which is so heavily influenced and inspired by French Baroque music. That sort of thing. I felt like, you know, I'm ready and I like what I'm doing right now, and I'm, you know, it's time to, you know, lay it down for posterity and share it with the world. So it all worked out.
Well, and you made a note that every time you revisit these works, you have a deeper understanding of them. And that also ties to the fact that there is a sheet music edition with your phrasing and dynamics that are also going to be released, your fingerings, your bowings. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, thanks for mentioning it. So my edition is coming out with my music publisher, Carl Fisher. And I'm super excited because it's not just, you know, my particular fingerings and bowings, like most editions, but, you know, Bach left very few dynamic indications on the page, which didn't mean that he wanted you to play it blah, but it meant that he wanted you to make your own choices and, you know, be personal and individual about it, which indeed everybody is. There is no one right way to play it. The only right way to play it is how you yourself truly feel it should go. And there might be 100 different answers to that because 100 different people have 100 different personalities, and that's the way it should be with this repertoire. So I don't want anybody to copy me necessarily, but I'm hoping that by putting down all of my thoughts on the page, which isn't usually done, that that will enable people to sort of get their own creative juices flowing and start to experiment and see if they like this idea and don't like that idea, and if they don't like it, what's their idea that they like better, and so forth. When it comes to the phrasing, a lot of it is helping people to gain an understanding of some of the dance forms if they haven't had a lot of background and experience in it. You know, not everybody has time or inclination to indulge in playing, you know, 30 or 40 other bourrées before going at one of Bach's. And you might, you know, play his bourrée like da yum bum 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 ba da da dum bum 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 ba da 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 dum, which can certainly be effective, but it's not a bourrée. And I feel like if you want to play it that way, great. You know, you can definitely make a case for it as working musically, but you should know that you're choosing to play it not like a bourrée. And if you do want to play a bourrée or experiment with trying to, then you should know that bourrées go 1-2-1-2 and 1-2-1-2. So da yum bum 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 ba da da bum 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 ba da 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 da, which is a totally different feel to the music. And there's nothing on the page to show you that in Bach's manuscript, but Bach would have assumed that you would have already known how a bourrée goes. But these days we don't necessarily know that. So that's the kind of information that I tried to impart with my edition.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, one of the dance movements, because something I didn't realize is that Bach uses different spellings of the same movements to imply stylistic differences. Can you give me a couple of examples? Or maybe you just did with the bourrée.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, like for, as far as the three partitas go, what's interesting is to us in the 21st century, it all seems like ancient Baroque music. But to somebody in Bach's lifetime, they would have experienced partita number one as a little bit of a throwback to the 17th century, sort of looking to an older type of aesthetic with the variations of the movements, which were very much a 17th century type of practice, even the Sarabande movement, which doesn't have the emphases on the second beats like we get in so many high Baroque Sarabandes, but was a more flowing type of tempo of a movement by the same name that they would have done a generation earlier. Then the second partita with the famous Chaconne, that particular one is in the sort of mainstream European language of the time, which was very Italianate. And then the last one was in the new, modern, fashionable French style. And so, you know, Bach is really being cutting edge with that one. So it's interesting to note how he clues you into this with his movement titles. But the music itself is so, if you've experienced all of these other styles, it's so obvious what language he's calling upon when he writes them. And so, you know, I phrase, you know, something in the the E major differently than I would in the D minor. So there's, you know, people who know how to play Baroque style and it goes like this. Well, which country's Baroque style? Which which centuries Baroque style. There's so many permutations, so many stylistic details, and it's fun to just try to, you know, get closer and closer to this sort of unattainable ideal that you might imagine for the music.
Now, these sonatas and partitas aren't just a collection. They're actually intended to be a cycle. Is that right?
Well, I don't know that Bach ever intended for anybody to do what I've frequently done and play them all in a single evening. I like to think that he would have been tickled that audiences wanted to experience that. But I don't think he ever would have done that. But definitely the way he laid them out in his book, you know, the two types of multi-movement forms, the so-called sonata da chiesa or church sonata, which is slow, fast music with typically a second movement, which is very contrapuntal music that would have been considered appropriate for playing during church services in the Baroque era. And then the other type, the sonata da camera, chamber sonata, sonatas not for the church, basically suites of dance music. Those two types, the church sonatas and the dance suites, Corelli really codified that those two forms in 1700 with the publication of his Opus 5, 12 sonatas. And Bach adheres to those forms, but he doesn't do three sonatas and then three partitas. He certainly could have, but he doesn't, which means that there's something going on here where he has a symmetry going throughout the cycle. Even fun little things that, you know, maybe don't mean too much to the listener, but, you know, his fugues go from short to medium to longest. His voicing in the third movements of the three sonatas goes from three voices to two to nearly one. And as I said, the partitas stylistically go from past to present to future. So there's a lot of that kind of motion going on. And there's also, you know, mathematical key relationships and things like that. But the best example of how a sonata actually leads to a partita is the last movement of the C major sonata, which very much sounds like a close cousin of the movement that follows immediately afterward, which is the prelude of the E major partita. And it makes so much sense to go from that one to the next one, which just shows you that they're not just in the collection randomly.
Well, we should talk about your violin since it, of course, is front and center. Tell me a little bit about your Del Gesu, which comes from the time of Bach, technically, near the end of his life anyway.
Yeah, well, the violin that I'm very lucky to play, excuse me while I yawn, you are interview number 17 of 20.
You just, oh my gosh. Well, I know you need oxygen, but listen to how energetic and excited you are.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, talking about Bach all day is, you know, what could be better? The violin that I'm very lucky to play was made in 1742 in Cremona, Italy, by the great Guarneri del Gesu. And like all of the Guarneris and Stradivaris and Amatis, for that matter, it was made as a Baroque violin, meaning it had a shorter neck set at a lower angle, shorter fingerboard, gut strings, basically everything at a lower tension, which meant less volume and projection, but greater detail of nuance. And of course, it would have been paired with a Baroque-style bow, which was still curved outwards like the old medieval bow and arrow primitive kind of bow, and made out of snake wood, which is more flexible. It was in the classical era into the beginning of the Romantic era when people wanted to simply get louder. And so violins were re-necked. They would take the old violin, chop off its neck, and put on a new one, put on a longer tailpiece and fingerboard, a heavier bass bar inside, and pair it with a totally new concept of bow with the stick curved inwards made out of Pernambuco wood. All of these innovations designed to give more sustain, more power. And certainly the new equipment plays Brahms much better than the old stuff. But when you want to play Baroque music, I always find that it brings the music more fully to life to use the Baroque equipment. But when I'm on the road playing all kinds of mixed programs in different scenarios, I can't always bring multiple violins with me. And I end up, you know, if I'm doing a Baroque concert, I'm going to play a Baroque violin. But with unaccompanied Bach, it ends up being part of mixed concerts so often, like a concerto followed by a Bach encore, or, you know, an appearance at a radio station where I'll do some Paganini caprices and Isai sonata and a little Bach, or, you know, private soirees for patrons, school visits, outreach performances. All these different times when I'm playing unaccompanied Bach, I'm doing it on my modernized violin. But by picking up a Baroque bow and using that bow on the violin, and of course you can fit multiple bows in one violin case, so that's no problem for travel. You know, using the Baroque bow, I feel like I'm able to do most of what I want. And, you know, it just has such a lively effect for the dances. It can be sweet yet full of vitality. And it, frankly, makes the 3- and 4-note chords so much easier. It's like even if you're not interested in Baroque style for its own sake, if you want to try to play those chords, it's a much better tool for the job. Kind of like if you were out on the golf course and you were choosing the right iron for that shot. I recorded these works on modernized violin with Baroque bow because that's how I have most frequently played it in my life and am likely to continue to most frequently play it that way.
So tell me about the title of this recording. You call it Testament, and it has more than one meaning. Is that right?
Oh, a myriad of them. You know, it's a testament to Bach's genius, you know, that he composed these amazing works in the first place. It's a testament to Bach's role in my life, helping me learn about, you know, what it means to be a musician. It's a testament to all of those who have taught me and inspired me and helped me, you know, get to the point that I've gotten in my understanding of Bach. Just so many different things. It seemed like the perfect title.
So I'm curious, what's next for you? What are you most excited about now that this Bach recording is about to be released? What's Rachel really excited about next? And maybe it has nothing to do with classical music.
Well, actually, I mean, recording-wise, my Paganini Caprices are going to come out next. That they're already in the can. I've got some concerto albums in the pipeline that I'm really looking forward to. In my own performing life, I'm just going around doing all kinds of different stuff. But the thing, musically speaking, that is the most just rewarding lately is doing violin with my daughter. She's been studying for about 1.5 years. She's 4 now. And just a couple months ago, she finally got the hang of being able to play her own separate part while I play a harmony so that we can do duets together. And that's just been a dream come true. And it's so fun to experience her discovering music and getting excited about it and to be able to play with her. And, oh, such a joy.
Well, I could totally hear a little encore from the two of you on one of your future recordings.
Well, we shall see. I just want her to keep enjoying it. And, you know, that's the most important thing. However serious about it she becomes later on is up to her. But, you know, I want her to have a true love of music and understanding of music.
Well, is there anything else you want to add? That was the extent of my questions.
I think we've pretty well covered it.
Yeah, you're very thorough. Thank you very much. Thanks for your time, Rachel.
Thank you.
All righty. Have a good day.
Take care.
Bye-bye. I'm counting down my 6 favorite interviews of the year. Next week, it's a conversation with Yo-Yo Ma and Johnny Gandelsman from the Silk Road Ensemble. I'm Julie Almacher, and this is New Classical Tracks Uncut.